Thank you so much. I am grateful to the Wisest, Teddy and Ariella, as well as the kids who were involved in setting up this evening. Thank you so much for hosting this Malava Malka. The idea to have Malava Malka Shiurim started for our Beit Midrash at some point a little over a year ago, when we realized that we, thank God, have a presence in Thornhill and we have a presence in the Clanton Park or Chaim area. And while we've been giving Shiurim in this area for 8 years, largely at Shari Shemayim, but also we had a weekly Shiur at Shomrei Shabbos for most of the time, it's an area that we haven't served as much. And so we thought maybe having a few of these Malava Malka programs each year would be nice. And I want to thank Eli Bienenstock, as well as Pesach Goldman and Absentia for their help in setting these up. I am Mordechai Torchiner with the Yeshiva University Torah Mitzion Beit Midrash Zichron Dov. Just to introduce them, Rabbi Jonathan Ziering, our Sagan, is over here. Yaron Peretz, right over there. And Adam Friedman is over there. Okay. So the topic for tonight is the Jew in December, holiday parties, greetings, and gifts. There are all sorts of nuances that theoretically could be asked, in addition to the items that I'm going to get to, and maybe at the end there'll be some time for further questions about some of the topics and subtopics that I don't discuss. The only thing I do want to note, as I always say when giving a shiur on halachic matters, is that I am a firm believer in the idea of the Mara de Asra, a firm believer in the idea that the shul rabbi should have all the joy of paskening on things like this. So please don't take what I am saying as psak. Please do make sure to speak to your rav for actual psak. I'm going to give you three cases that I want to address. The first one, Chaim is a lawyer. By the way, if there happens to be a Chaim in the room who is a lawyer, don't know. Chaim is a lawyer. He's invited to his firm's multi-denominational holiday party. So they have a tree, and they have a menorah, and you know who knows what else. There's a movie about a non-denominational party. What's it called? What did it get on Rotten Tomatoes? Okay, fine. Okay. Excellent. So he knows that his superiors in the firm view his attendance at the party as a gauge of his level of investment in the firm. So is he allowed to attend this holiday party? That's the first question. Second question. Sarah purchases a coffee at, let's say, Starbucks. Once you're into one controversial issue, you could always introduce more. And it's December 24th. And the person who gives her the coffee wishes her happy holidays. So how should she respond? Not wanting to be rude, but on the other hand, well, most years, it wouldn't be the time of her holiday. This year it happens to be that it'd also be Hanukkah. But that's a second question. And then the third question, Rivka knows that her neighbors customarily tip the person who delivers the mail before the holidays. She doesn't want to seem stingy. She doesn't want to seem like she's not generous. On the other hand, she feels it's inappropriate to give a holiday bonus like that. So what should she do? Those are the three questions that I'm hoping to look at. So in order to do this, I want to frame the conversation a little bit in terms of a greater philosophical context. We are given many role models within Tanakh for every aspect of human behavior, but especially in terms of what we're going to talk about this evening, in terms of the way that a Jew interacts with the greater community of humanity. And if we just narrow it down, in the interest of time, I would suggest that there are four good models right there in Sefer Bereishis, in Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and Yosef. There's more you could say, especially if you expand it to the Imahot and their experience with the non-Jews around them. But for simplicity, I'm just sticking to Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and Yosef. If you had to pick which of these you would identify with in terms of your relationship with the non-Jewish world, with the world around us, knowing that each of them had a unique style, which of them would you pick? Yosef. A lot of Yosef. Why? You feel like you're the economic wizard guiding the government? What is it about Yosef?
Steeped in their liberalism, right? That's what they're in the secular world.
Right. He lived in their world. Okay. So Yosef is a model? Could be. Yosef's a problematic model, right? Yosef is not a simple model. He engages the world as a Jew. This is true. He wants safe space for Jews, right? What's the advice that Yosef gives to his brothers when they come down? Tell them that you're shepherds, and that way you'll be able to take land off in Goshen. You won't have to get involved with the rest of Mitzrayim. However, Yosef is also very standoffish when you think about it in terms of religious identity. He makes sure to tell everybody he is an Ivri. Everybody knows that Yosef is different. However, he doesn't proselytize at all. It's not as though he is trying to convince anybody of anything. Contrast that with an Avraham, right? Avraham thinks that everything is an opportunity to go tell the world about his vision of Hashem. Vayikra Sham B'Shem Hashem Kel Olam. He called out in the name of Hashem. The Chiti know him as Nisi Elokim, the Prince of God. He's very clearly known that way. Malkitzedek comes to him and feels very comfortable saying Baruch Kel Elyon in a conversation with Avraham. Avraham is very engaged with the world, right? He has these friends, Aner, Eshkol, and Mamre, who are willing to go to war with him. Abraham is very out there in the world. Maybe the model should be the model of an Abraham. And then on the other hand, you have a Yitzchak, right? Yitzchak retreats from the world. When he has to interact with it, it doesn't go well, right? Avimelech and Gerar being a case in point. But Yitzchak in general is sort of off on his own, never leaves the land of Israel, is told in, you know, specifically when he goes down, he's going to go to Mitzrayim. God says, stop there. Don't leave the land. You have Yitzchak who retreats from the world. Or maybe a Yaakov model, right? What's Yaakov's model in terms of his engagement with the world around him? How would you characterize Yaakov if you had to pick a word? Yaakov's a fighter. Yaakov fights to make space for himself and for his family in the world around him. Esav, Lavan, you know, Shem. Yaakov is forever at odds with the world around him. The Sifsei Chacham makes a startling comment. You know, when news comes back to Yaakov that Yosef is alive, it says Vayafag libo kilo ha'emin lahem, right? Which the commentators generally assume means his heart stops because he can't believe Yosef. I thought Yosef was dead years ago. I sat shiva for him. I thought it was over. That's the usual way to take it. If you look at Sifsei Chachamim on Vayafag Libo, it says that he can't believe that Yosef has retained his status as a Jew. He can't believe that Yosef is still loyal because Yaakov lives at odds with the world around him. And to him, if Yosef has become part of it, if Yosef is now Moshel B'chol Eretz Mitzrayim, he's reigning over Egypt, he must have stopped being the Yosef I remember. He must now be part of the part of broader society. He's unable to believe that Yosef has actually retained his loyalty. So we have these different models. We have Abraham who engages and wants to convince the world. We have Yitzchak who retreats from the world. We have Yaakov who fights the world. And we have Yosef who engages it, but still wants to be off to the side a little bit, like as is seen in his Goshen type of advice. As a matter of fact, if you're familiar at all with Professor Mordechai Zer Kavod, one of the editors of the Dat Mikra edition of Tanakh, he has a fascinating article in which he identifies four different types of citizenship in Tanakh. What terms does the Torah use to describe the way a Jew lives in somebody else's land? Ger is one, Toshav is another. Ezrach, good. And the other one is Nochri. There is Ger Toshav, there's Ger, there's Nochri, and there's Ezrach. And I would suggest that you could take his four labels and link them to each of these figures, meaning that Avram is clearly Ger Toshav because he identifies that way in the Chumash. He is somebody who has settled in. He is a Toshav. He lives among them with his own identity, but he's living among them. Yitzchak is Ger. He is the fulfillment of Ger Yehiya Zaracha. When Hashem says to Avraham, your children are going to be Gerim, they're going to be strangers. Yitzchak is a stranger, even though he's in his own land. Yaakov is the Nochri. No alliances work out for Yaakov. The Nochri is a foreigner. Nothing works out for Yaakov in connection with the people around him. And Yosef is the Ezrach. Ezrach is a resident. He's a permanent resident. He owns land. So you have these four different identities. And to my mind, the halachic prescriptions that we have in terms of dealing with the problems of the Jew in December are shaped by those early experiences in Sefer Bereishis of Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and Yosef. I gave you on the sheet in number one references to a few psukim. If you look at those, and if you have a head for Bereishis and you realize what those are describing, the first of those is from the beginning of Parshas Lech Lecha. Story in the beginning of Lech Lecha that involves a Jewish encounter with the greater world. What's that story? Beginning of Lech Lecha, Jewish encounter with the greater world. Give you a hint, it happens in Egypt. Right, Abraham, Sarah, and Paro. Right? That shapes our view in very practical ways of what to expect in society. Abraham and Sarah are going down to Mitzrayim because they have no choice, because there's no food anywhere else, and they conclude that the first thing that's going to happen is Sarah is going to be taken, and the only question is Abraham going to survive or not? That's a very kind of harsh view of what to expect. Then, Bereishis Lamed Daled, also not a high point in Jewish non-Jewish relations. This is from next week's Parsha, Parshas Vayishlach. And that's the story of Dinah and Shechem. And then the last one that I brought you is Yosef's instructions to his brothers saying, you know, you're better off living in Goshen. You find these interactions that the Talmud of Chumash, someone who's going to read Chumash, is going to look at and say, you know, I have to be very leery, I have to be very careful about this world in which I'm interacting. At the same time, we are told that bracha is going to come to the nations as a result of us, that somehow or other we are going to have a positive impact that's going to lead to something good, not just in the community of Jews, but in the greater world. We have all of the various nevuahs, all the various prophecies, which speak of an ultimate time when the world is going to say, we want to learn Torah, we want to embrace Judaism. Yechezkel says, v'hizgadilti v'hizgadishti le'enei amim rabim. Hashem says, through Yechezkel, I am going to be elevated and sanctified in the eyes of many nations. We're going to light our menorah, right, in a short period of time, and put the menorah, hopefully outdoors, out in the window, somewhere where the world is able to see it. And that mitzvah, Pirsumei Nisa, according to many, although not according to everyone, is a mitzvah not just for Jews to see, but for the world to see. There is a sense of not retreating and not drawing back entirely. There's much more to be said on the topic, but I think it's very clear that there is this idea of being part of the world, even as we have these models that scare us, that are seen in Sefer Bereishis. If you take a look at the second source on the sheet, you find the value, which is going to be very important in this halachic conversation, from the Gemara in Gittin. We are supposed to support needy non-Jews along with needy Jews. We visit ill non-Jews along with ill Jews. We bury their deceased along with ours. It doesn't mean in the same cemetery, but it means that we take care of their deceased as well. In pursuit of shalom, in pursuit of peace. There is a halachic value of engaging with the world for this in a way that will increase peace. And whether one looks at that in a utilitarian way of, we have to live in this world, so therefore we want to make sure that we get along with others, or whether you look at it as more of a value of, we actually want there to be shalom with the world around us, you can't dispute that it is a halachic value. And so when you have a Jew who says, I'm not going to go to the party, I'm not going to give a gift, I don't want to respond when they say happy holidays, you have to ask, so how does that interface with such a value of shalom? On the other hand, one more negative in number three is the caution that we see within halacha. The specifics in which this is brought may be a little bit beyond this evening, actually. I think I'm not going to go into the whole context. It's a law in Erev Chatzeros. But basically, it's a law which was designed in order to keep a Jew from living in close proximity with non-Jews, lest he learn from the deeds of the nations. So that what we're seeing here is this, on the one hand, desire to be close, and on the other hand, fear of being close with the world. And there isn't one model that's correct. meaning for every particular model, for every particular example you're going to find from Tanakh or Jewish history of somebody who lived one way, you're going to find other models of others who lived another way, right? The Rambam is always a favorite example of people who want to talk about the cosmopolitan Jew. You have Shmuel HaNagid, you have Don Isaac Abarbanel, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Yeah, okay, fine, but we could bring dozens more who did not engage and who in fact withdrew and said we want nothing to do with the world around us. So it's important to recognize, number one, we have multiple models within Torah. Number two, no particular model can claim dominance and say this is the way that the Jew is supposed to interact. But number three, when we establish a derech, when we establish a way to deal with these questions as they come up, we have to ask ourselves, who am I following? Which is my model here? Do I have a consistent and coherent approach? Clear? Okay. So let's move into the holiday party question. Yeah.
So I'm just wondering if you're trying to say that different people may have different halachas.
That was not the topic this evening. No. The answer is not so much that different individuals may choose to do things differently, and say, "Well, I have is a halacha. What I have is a halacha." As much as the derech hapsak, the path that's going to guide whoever's going to determine, you know, what should be done, will be influenced by these models. And you will go to multiple poskim and you will get different answers on some of these issues, biased by different models that are found within Torah. It's not as though you could expect that if you go to 100 rabbis, you will get the same answer 100 times. It's not necessarily true. That's what I'm saying. Yes. That's always the nace, right? The nace of the Targum Shivim. Right? If you remember the classic in the Medrash is that the Targum Shivim, this translation of the Torah into 70 languages, is miraculous because Ptolemy supposedly takes 70 sages, puts them in 70 different rooms, and they all change things about the Chumash that they feel should be changed out of sensitivity. And they all change the same things, and they all come out with the same result. And my answer is always, the bigger nace would have been if they were all in the same room and they came out with the same result. Anyway. Hopefully the same. Hopefully the same. But yeah, I hear that. I hear the comparison. Okay. So attending a holiday party means that you've already made a decision, right? Attending a holiday party means you're not Yitzchak. Yitzchak is going to stay home. He's not going to the party. What Yaakov would do at the party would be a very interesting question. But someone who's going to a holiday party, generally speaking, is someone who is more along the Yosef model of things. I think it's really more what you're going to see. I'm assuming, for the sake of the example that we gave, that there's kosher food, available at it, number one. And number two, that no one would think you're eating treif. In other words, I don't want to deal with the Maris Ayin question. I don't want to deal with the appearances question because it's really its own shear in its own right. But I will stipulate that whoever is going to the party has to be really, really sure that the world is not going to think that they're eating from the treif food. That's a given in order for this to go anywhere. So in terms of going to this party, yeah. You may actually be better if there's no kosher food. In other words, you go and you don't have anything. You're not holding a plate. You're not holding a cup. Then it's very clear you're not eating. You're not drinking. The problem becomes when you had kosher food on your plate and now there's very little left. And now someone looks at it and isn't going to know which stuff you took from. So in some ways, you're better off if there's no kosher food. It isn't. I'm just saying that the assumption is that we're not dealing with the Maris Ayin question. So. The truth of the matter is that in order to address this question, we actually have to go back a step. Because the question isn't a holiday party question. The question is a party question before we ever get to the holidays. If there's going to be a party, if my non-Jewish neighbor is going to hold a party and invite me to his house and it has nothing to do with any holidays, am I allowed to go to that? Generally speaking, halachic values are very concerned with social events having nothing to do with Avodah Zarah. I gave you an example of this from source number 15 from the Rambam. It's really a Gemara, but the Rambam was a succinct way to express it. Talking about the issue of Bishul Akum, right? We have a Gezerah Derabbanan, we have a rabbinic decree prohibiting eating food which is 100% kosher, but cooked by a non-Jew, right? It could have been cooked in your kitchen with your utensils and everything else. That's a bad idea, incidentally, because it may render the utensils trafe. But the but if a non-Jew cooks kosher food in kosher utensils, nonetheless, it's still aser as Bishul Akum. However, the type of food that is prohibited in this context is specifically that which is elevated food. Food that you would serve on an occasion when you want to impress people. If you take a look, it's verse number 4 from the Rambam. She'ikar gzeira mishum chasnus. He says the essential decree that's involved is a decree due to concern for marriage. Shelo yizamnu ha'akum etzlo b'se'uda. He says, the concern is for invitations for meals. The concern is he's going to invite you over, you're going to invite him over, you're going to eat together, and you start to realize what, you know, frankly, Jews have, you know, realized in great numbers since the time of the emancipation in Europe, which is, you know, non-Jews can be nice people also, and they can be wonderful people with great values and everything else. They're not ours. But they can be good people, and therefore the attraction starts to develop. So what the Rambam is identifying here is really from the Gemara that you want to avoid that kind of socialization, and so you don't have together, or you don't use, I should say, food that they cooked if it is the sort of food that you would eat at a king's table. Now, does that mean I can get together with them for something that's not food at a king's table? I can get together with them for coffee. I can get together with them for something that's not so high end. The answer is the Bishul Akum is at least not a concern on such an occasion. Why? Because when you're dealing with fancier occasions, when you're dealing with something that has a higher degree of social interaction, then we do have concerns about where it's going to lead. And so I apply that to the party question and say that's where this is going to become a halachic concern. If you take a look at source number 5 from the Shulchan Aruch, this is also, it's a Gemara in Avodah Zarah, but I found the Shulchan Aruch to be a clear way to present it. Ovid kochavim ha'osa mishta lechupas b'no obito. If he's marrying off his son or daughter, asur liyisrael le'achol sham, a Jew is not allowed to eat there. Afilu ochlam bishalo, even if he's eating his own food, Vishamash Shalo, he has his own servant serving it, Omed Alav Mishamish. Nonetheless, it's still not allowed. I can't eat at that wedding because it's a social occasion which might lead to an intensifying of my interaction with them. Clear?
Is it specific thing
in Obed Kochavim? No. Correct. No. Obed Kochavim is stated here more likely because of the censors than anything else. It means someone who isn't Jewish. Correct.
So what have we had this discussion before? Because I've been with some others here learning what those are, a little bit, understanding a little bit of it. Is that what's these two things are really associated, that's a shame, right?
Why?
But what's fundamental here, what I don't think is elucidated here by the Shulchan Aruch concept, is the concept of the fact of breaking the circle, the completion of the circle. Mm-hmm. Right, which is what I guess we can do when we have a Bishul Akum. We talk about turning on a stove, even pulling up corn. It doesn't mean that the goy knows that we're doing it.
You know, correct.
One or the other will break that circle either right. Which way. But it's amazing, it's appealing to me that it seems, or maybe it's apparent, that in the specific hanhaga of this situation that Rabbi Sakhar is talking about, that if you're coming with this environment, whatever you're doing is not breaking that circle.
Correct. Well, he's saying don't eat. That's his breaking of the circle. What Eddie is pointing out is a theory I've heard from Eddie before. The no, that wasn't a laugh line. That was true. It's the idea that what we require is simply that there should be some kind of disruption of the social bond on either side, either the Jew or the non-Jew, something that will signal this isn't You know, this isn't something that's okay to intensify and develop further. So when you talk about in cases of bishulakum and pasakum and throwing something into the oven and interfering with it in some minor way, well, you haven't changed the substance of anything, but yet you've reminded yourself that this is not normal, that this is not what should go on. So what I think he's doing here is he's saying you're disrupting it by not eating. That's a fact. He didn't say you can't go to the wedding, right? He said you can't eat at the wedding.
And specifically for a wedding?
Yes. Specific to wedding, correct.
The Gemara is commenting on this. Once you've accepted the invitation, you violate from when you accept the invitation. It's not about eating. It's about go. It's about...
Unless it's no, because it's you put yourself in a situation. In other words, if you had accepted the hazmana but said, I'm not eating...
Right, so that would be fine, but you can't like accept being the implication of the Mars. You can't say I'm going to come, you know, make the implication you're going to eat, and then
right. Rabbi Zirin points out accurately that the Gemara says that you can't even accept the invitation unless you're going to say I'm coming, but don't prepare any food for me, kosher or otherwise. Yes, Jeff.
Does any or all of these things differ whether you're talking about attending a function that's being put on by your business partner, as opposed to your neighbor, where there's no business interest and there's nothing
on
the relationship?
Good question. I'm getting there. It is it's a good question, though.
Does the amount of Jews at the party or at the function make a difference?
Right. So apparently not. There, actually, the next halacha in the Shulchan Aruch talks about even where the Jews are sort of on their own at the party, even still viewing it as problematic. Now, there's actually, it's unclear. The Rambam has language which indicates that if the Jews are on their own, it may be okay. So it's not so clear-cut that you could, if you had a Jewish table, you know, it could be the Rambam would say that it's actually fine. So
the Shverish, they had their own section.
Yes.
And yet it was a problem.
But there's also, when you're dealing with Sudas HaChashverosh, you actually move more towards the holiday party concern because of what it's supposed to represent. Right. If you look in the Gemara, which talks about them eating at Achashverosh's meal, it also suggests that that meal was because Achashverosh thought that Judea Capta, so to speak, to plant Latin on Achashverosh, that he thought that now 70 years had passed and we didn't have the second Beis Hamikdash and we didn't have our return to our land, and therefore that meant Jews would be part of his empire forever. So for Jews to go and eat at that party would be something like Jews are going and celebrating at a holiday party, and I don't mean of ours, the same sort of concept. But moving through the issue of concerns for socializing, we've now seen it in terms of the Bishul Akum issue and not eating something that is of a nice quality that they cooked. We see it about the wedding. I also brought in number 6, the issue of Shechar Shal Ovdei Kochavim, which is not an issue of wine. It's a separate issue. This has nothing to do with Stam Yenam. Shechar Shalov Kochavim is the issue of not drinking intoxicating drinks with them, which is really its own discussion, and maybe at the end, if Rabbi Zirin wants, he actually has a shiur that he's given on coffee and the question of socializing over coffee. I'm going to skip it for now in the interest of time, but if people want to discuss that one at the end, that's its own. But what we see, what you get an overwhelming impression here is that we're really uncomfortable with overall socializing and parties. Then when you add in the holiday party, you add in two more areas of trouble. One, the appearance of accepting Avodah Zarah. And here you can go back to the Gemara Megillah Daf Yud Beis and the discussion about Achashverosh's meal. And does participating at his meal signify an acceptance of that which he is celebrating? And the question then for the Jew, in terms of going into such an occasion, would be, does the Jew appear to be accepting what is for us Avodah Zarah? Right? There's a whole other question, which I'm going to get to a little bit later, of is Christianity Avodah Zarah for a non-Jew? And I want to talk about that a little bit. But there's no doubt that it's Avodah Zarah for a Jew. Right? The concern is that I'm going to look like I am accepting it. That's no good. Right, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, which I brought you in source number 8, identifies for us that we are not allowed to join the name of God with other things, and that would include accepting Christianity. For a Jew, it's certainly a problem, and a Jew is not allowed to pretend to accept it. And I'm not talking now about life or death situations and Holocaust things and all that, but as a general principle, Jews are not allowed to accept, to pretend that they are following the ways of the world around them. I brought you the Rambam in Hilchos Avodah Zarah in source number 9, which you can see there. So aside from the socializing concern, there's a concern for a period to accept Avodah Zarah. And then there's a third concern. And the third concern is that maybe your participation strengthens their belief and enthusiasm, causes them to say, ah, the Jew came, the Jew participated, and they're happier and celebrate in a stronger way as a result. And here, the question of, well, is Christianity really Avodah Zarah or not becomes more relevant, because the question is it Avodah Zarah for them? Now, as a matter of practice, you can't really... you can't really say anything about Christianity as a whole because it has so many different denominations which have themselves different beliefs regarding regarding the Trinity, regarding what they believe about the nature of God, regarding whether they worship saints, and that sort of thing. But I brought you in source number 11, Tosfos in Bechoros. This is the classic Tosfos that stirs up a lot of debate. He's talking about the issue of doing business with someone who isn't Jewish, in which you're going to both swear to whatever agreement you're making. So by entering into this agreement with him, you are now triggering for him to swear in the name of his God. So Tosfos here writes, "Afal pi shemazkirin imahem shem shamayim v'kavanasam v'kavanasam." There are some issues in the manuscript. I'm just not gonna play with the manuscript aspect. But even though they mention the name of God, and what they mean is their Avodah Zarah, he says, Ein ze shem avodas kochavim. That's not called idolatry. Ki daitam l'shem osei shamayim v'aretz. They simply mean creator of heaven and earth. Ve'av agav shemishtatev shem shamayim v'davar acher. Granted that they combine God with something else. Ein kan lifnei iver lo sitein michshol. There's nothing wrong with you causing him to do that. You're not making him stumble. Dibnei namach lo huzaru al kach. Because Noahites are not necessarily prohibited from doing that, meaning shituf, the idea of joining God with other entities, may not be Avodah Zarah for them. Tosfos says explicitly, it is not Avodah Zarah for them. And that from that comes the idea that maybe for them, Christianity is not actually Avodah Zarah. Now, there are opposing views. For starters, that may not exactly be what Tosfos is saying. It may be that what Tosfos is saying here is not they're allowed to join Hashem with other gods. It could be what he's saying is that swearing that way is specifically not prohibited for them, but that the belief is still prohibited. That's based on the Ran, which I brought you in number 12. So others argue that even Tosfos believes that Christianity would constitute Avodah Zarah for them, and there are others who indeed believe that as well. But here, when you're dealing with a holiday party, your concern is that maybe if you're going to celebrate, go to this party with them, number one, it looks like you're taking part, like you believe in it. And number two, that you cause them to be energized and enthused in their own celebration. Now, you could argue against these latter two points very easily. Number one, the argument can be made, and the argument is made, that people don't really read into holiday party celebrations in our day and where we live. The holiday party is basically an excuse to have a party. In some businesses, it may well just be an event that the firm likes because it gets everybody together and they all have a good time together and it's good, you know, team, what's the word I'm looking for? Not team building, but something along those lines. Sorry?
It's good for morale.
Yeah, it's good for morale. And that argument, I think, is a valid argument in many of these cases, particularly once they go beyond making it of one holiday, and they start to invite in the menorah, it's very clear that this is not a religious celebration for them. The argument goes as well that, you know, many of them are themselves not observant of their religion. They may be socially, you know, socially whatever it is, but that they're not embedded in this. And it's not as though you going to the party is going to make them more invested in their religious belief. So that's an argument against these concerns of appearing to accept Avodah Zarah, as well as concerns for making them more enthusiastic in the Avodah Zarah. And then there's an added consideration, which goes back towards what Jeff was pointing out, which is, what about the potential losses involved in not participating. One case would be the business case. The example I gave in the beginning, where the firm is going to look on it negatively if you don't go to the party. And then there's the issue of eva, the issue of potential enmity. Take a look at source number 13, please. This is the Ritva commenting on the Gemara in Avodah Zarah. There's a story there which the Ritva kindly reproduces. Hahu mina'a d'shadar le'dinra kesar na'a, it should probably be, l'Rabbi Yehuda Nisiya b'yom edo. There was a min. Min in this context is referring to somebody who believed in something other than Judaism. So he sent a certain fine coin to Rabbi Yehuda Nisiya on the day of the festival. Havayasev Reish Lakish Kamei. Reish Lakish is sitting in front of him. Amar Hechi Avid. And Rabbi Yehuda Nisiya says, I don't know what to do. Ashkale, if I accept it, Azilumoda, then he's going to go thank his God. Lo Ashkale, but if I don't take it, Havile Eva, then there's going to be enmity. And that's the end of the piece that he brings from the Gemara. The rest of the story in the Gemara is interesting, but I'm not going to bring it right now. He says, what do I do? He gave me a gift. Do I accept the gift or do I not accept the gift? So the Ritva comments, Perish, V'chalhecha de'ika Eva lo asru b'mishnasenu klal va'afilu b'yom edam. If there really is a concern for enmity, the Mishnah will not prohibit any action, including accepting the gift, even on their holiday. She'isr ze'eno ela midirabanan, because the prohibition is fundamentally rabbinic. Umishum chashasha, and it's because of the concern that you're going to build up his religious fervor. Ulafichach lewachlitu ba'isuran v'lo hishvu midosayim. So they didn't apply it across the board. They didn't apply it in a case where it could create enmity. Now, there are degrees of enmity, right? For those who were at the Malav HaMalka last year, where we talked about treating terrorists and the issue of medical care for terrorists, so one of the concerns that was raised was, well, if you don't provide medical care, then maybe it will inspire enmity among the nations. They'll look at us and think we are not civilized. To which the response sometimes is, well, there are degrees of eva. There's a difference between they don't like us and a difference and they're out to kill us. You know, saying that maybe he won't like me as much because I didn't show up to the holiday party is not the same thing as saying he's going to kill me. Rabbi Yehuda Nisiya, living as he did, he's the grandson of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. He's living at the end of the 3rd century under the Romans. His vulnerability is different from our vulnerability today in Canada. If Rabbi Yehuda Nisiya runs afoul of the Roman by not accepting his gift, it could be his head tomorrow. Yeah, as opposed to, you didn't go to the holiday party, so you may get passed up for a bonus. Right? That may be what, or for a raise, or whatever it is. But hopefully, you know, I don't know where people work, but hopefully it won't result in a great vendetta against you. But that's another factor that has to be considered, is both what kind of a setting is this, and what is the price I'm going to pay in the event that I don't participate. So you see what we have. On the one side, we have concerns for socializing and where it could lead, as well as concerns involving Avodah Zarah, involving idolatry. On the other hand, you have the idea that they're not so invested in Avodah Zarah, and the potential penalty if I don't participate. So what we end up with, as a matter of practicality from halachic authorities in general, is that number one, if it's a religious party, really, you can't go. If it's actually a religious party, if they are doing a party which is, you know, they're going to get around and sing Silent Night or whatever it is, you don't belong there. That's just, the Jew shouldn't be involved. But if it's a party which is not really a religious party, so we still have our concern for socializing, and therefore the tendency is to follow more of a Yitzchak model and withdraw, but the posts can tend to understand that a Jew may choose to follow more of a Yosef model and say, I'm going to go, I'll be there for a little while, I'll smile and say hello, and then I'll leave. I have yet to see a posek who was willing to say, just go hang out, have a good time, you know, be there from you know, the beginning to end. They tend to want people to remain aware of our separation and to do the best they can to avoid being there too much. That's what I have seen in various Piskei Halach. That's on that question. Questions on that before we go to the next two of our scenarios, which are a little briefer. Yeah.
What if it's your husband? And what if you make it as parv as you possibly can, and you make sure you have kosher food, and any Jews, you know, have kosher food available or what have you? I mean,
Yeah. So.
I have to say, like, to me, they become more like year-end parties and more than anything. But you know, once a year, everyone wants a party.
Right. So my etza would be, if someone has the company and needs to make a party because everyone's expecting a party, they would be to try to move it away from the end of December. There you go. So if you do it at that point, now keep in mind, all you've accomplished though is you've gotten rid of the holiday aspects of it. You haven't gotten rid of the social aspects.
The HR department's still calling it the holiday party. Everyone's still calling it the holiday.
Even better.
And then you go to the place that you rented, wherever it is, and they put up a tree in the hallway and whatever. Like, you can't get.
But it's November. Never mind. I've been in stores in November.
Yeah.
I know.
I mean, you know, you really can't. We just had. I have like 5 this month. So like.
Wow.
Last month. Yeah, like it's nonstop. And
it's like Jewish weddings in June.
It's nonstop. And really, it's totally irreligious. Like, we completely remove, like, I think the thing is still called a holiday party when they send out the invitation or whatever, but it's like literally, it's about how we did this year, how the company's doing, how we're growing. It's awards for how many people have been there for 25 years plus. It's, you know, like, the entire conversation is about the company and morale building and, yes, have a good party and have a good time.
Yeah.
But it's like there's nothing. And really, I was just saying the decor. Then the decor is, like, you can't help it. We're in Toronto, Canada. Look around. Like, I mean, the decor. You
know, I actually once went into a store and I asked them what's with all the red and green. Yeah, it was. I was much younger in those days.
Yeah. No, but yeah. So we rented various halls. I mean, really, they were taking pictures of the Santa Claus hall. Like, we didn't have anything to do with it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So. I mean, I would go back to the initial point, which is the socializing, you know, issue, which is relevant no matter when you're gonna hold this. I think to the extent that it can be made to surround the business, you know, you're better off. Fundamentally, in the course of life, if you're going to play the role of being part of society, there is going to be some degree of socializing. And the truth of the matter is that we have Piskei Halacha all through the centuries of people who did. Like, they describe what they were doing, and you know, there were times in Jewish history when Jews would go over to non-Jews' houses and do this. Very observant people. It wasn't like it was an act that was contra halachic. So I wouldn't say that, you know, by dint of having such a celebration, you're automatically in trouble. At the same time, to the extent that it can be business focused, and I think to the extent that you can avoid the imagery of the holiday party, I think you're going to be on the, you know, on better halachic footing.
I have two more questions.
But it's all about Jews anyway, so they don't.
What? No, well, first of all, half the people are like totally not Christian. There's Indians. There's the room is of.
So just make it a Hanukkah party.
Like, yeah, there's like whatever.
Make it a Hanukkah party. You're all invited. Give the kale on the menorah. And
usually, when we get our kosher food served to us, it's wrapped up in cellophane and whatever. I mean, it's pretty obvious, is what we're all thinking. But what we did with one of ours, we had quite a few Jews, so we did a kosher buffet, and there was a big sign, it's a kosher buffet. And, you know, there was a rabbi protecting the food. They said, like, why does he have to protect the food? You know, so is that okay or not? That's one question. I'll ask my second question, because we made this up ourselves. And the wine, we had kosher wine at the table, obviously in the bushel. And there's lots of non-kosher wine everywhere. And I was trying to protect and make sure that, you know, we got... But then other people wanted the wine. Like, I felt like we are sharing it with them. But
why? Why can't they have kosher wine?
Okay.
Non-Jews are allowed to drink kosher wine, as far as I know. No, I mean, look, what you're describing as a scenario involves additional halachic questions that you know, I would rather not discuss like this. There are all sorts of other questions that come into play. I'm glad to discuss further, but I think I'm gonna move forward with this at this point.
I'll just interject one.
Go ahead.
I did find one posek. I think it's a brush called Cleveland, I'm sure, where Baruch Haim Hirschfeld, who argued that even the social problems, when it's a business, he thinks that because the whole issur was framed as a social problem, if it's really business, he thinks all the issurim just fall away, right?
And I think that's part of the. I think that.
Right. He's pretty comfortable with that, even on a social level.
Right. I think realistically, if you're not comfortable with that, you have problems with things that go on a day to day basis. Right. You know, a conversation at a water cooler becomes a problem, also. Jeff,
I just wanted to ask about a comment that you made, which is
if it's your company and you choose to have the holiday or the end of year party like in October or Dhaka in January, is that not going to lead to enmity by your employees? We can't even have a party. It's like you're doing it so Dhaka that it's not in the same.
It's my party. I'm entitled to do the party when I want.
Yeah, but we used to have a party on Thursday nights because we're all from Shabbos Shabbos Jews, and it got to the point where the entire, like everyone, they were upset. They were not happy. They wanted it on Saturday night or Friday night so that they could sleep in the next day and relax, whatever. And we lost that battle over time because people were just too...
I'm hoping it went to Saturday night.
Yes.
Just check it.
Which is very difficult, too. It's not in Toronto on time, so
right.
Hard.
Okay. The second and the last two items are more brief than the first, but the issue of responding to holiday the issue of responding to holiday greetings. So yeah, I may choose to be Avraham, and I'm going to tell the world all about what I believe in and Hashem. And when they try to tell me Mary whatever, I'm going to say to them, actually, I don't follow that. I indeed celebrate Hanukkah, and I wish you a lot of luck. Yeah. You might encounter Ephron Hachiti, who knows? But the sorry. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's nice. People are sending cards. They are. It's nice that they send cards. But yeah, the question is fundamentally, what do we do about it? We have an isser. We have a prohibition. I gave it to you in actually earlier in number 10, and I skipped it. I skipped reading it aloud, but you can see it there. Shem Elohim Acherim Lo says, Kiru Lo Yishama Al Picha. You shall not mention the names of the gods of other people. Those names should not be heard upon your mouth. I am not allowed to utter the names of Avodah Zarah. So what exactly will we do? How does that relate to the names of their holidays? December 25th, obviously. How does it relate to dealing with these greetings? So Rabbi Yosef Karo on the Shulchan Aruch in source number 14 tells you, Shem Chagim Shalahem, Shem Shemos Bnei Adam, the names of their holidays, which are just like the names of their of human beings, Ein Chashash LaHazkiram. There's nothing wrong with mentioning them. V'hu Shalo Yekreim K'moshem Hazkiram Osam Ha'ovde Kochavim B'lashon Chashivus. However, you can't do it respectfully. You're not supposed to say it in an honorable way, like this is something that you consider to be of value. The problem is that the names that we're talking about don't have that kind of status. They're not the names of human beings. I mean, the Vilna Gaon wrote in number 15, his comment on that spot in the Shulchan Aruch, he quotes Lagos Mamonios, is quoting Rabbi Leon Mizrahi, who says, She'ein aser ela shem shenitan la l'shem elokut, abal shem hedyotos, etc. He says, the names that are given to convey divinity, those are the ones that are prohibited. Normal names are permitted. V'chein t'nan, and so he quotes you the Mishnah in Avodah Zarah, and they list names of various festivals that were known from Roman times, Kalanda, Saturnura, Kartasim, these are okay. She'elu shmos hedyotos hein, because these were normal names. I don't think they're normal names now, but they were then. Uvakam makomos huzgar oso ha'ish v'talmidav b'shas, and he says, Yeshu is mentioned all through the Gemara, and no one has a problem calling him Yeshu. That's his name. So in general, if the names are normal human names, then it tends to be okay. But what about Yeshu's last name? What am I supposed to do with that? I mean, that name is meant to indicate the status of a king. That's what it is. It's essentially saying King Yeshu. That's what it is. So the question is, would one be allowed to say such a thing? So there are many who believe that it is indeed usher, that it is indeed prohibited. Rav Mordechai Willig at YU gave a shirim which he quoted Rav Scheinberg. And Rav Scheinberg said that you would be allowed to say it. As long as you don't say the two names together, you're okay. In other words, I'm saying this for the sake of Lahavin Ulaharos, for people to learn Torah, and no one should read anything into me using names now, and don't cut and paste from my audio recording. But if someone were to just say the word Christ, he's not saying that someone is it. He's just saying, it's like saying Mashiach. He's just saying Melech, out in a vacuum. That was Rav Scheinberg's position, which I find very interesting and a little bit hard to accept. Because I think that if you were to say that anywhere in this world, they would know exactly what you meant. There would be absolutely no confusion about who you were talking about. So, frankly, I have a hard time with that as a heter. What about talking about his birthday? So if, you know, and again, using the term just as a part of teaching Torah, if a person were to say Christmas, would they be in violation? It's the birthday of Mashiach. That's what they think. So, you know, would a person be allowed to say it? So the general assumption is that one should not say it in the context of identifying it as a special day. Offering somebody a greeting, a merry greeting would be inappropriate. The Rav Willig's position in his shir on the topic is that you should even avoid saying happy holiday because it looks like you are celebrating. He's much happier with happy new year. He's good with happy new year because New Year's doesn't have any sort of religious overtones for people today, even if it did at some point in the past. Today, no one looks at it that way. So he's much happier with happy new year. Realistically, knowing that in our society, the phrase happy holiday has come to mean, I don't celebrate anything that you're talking about, and this is just a polite way for us to, you know, grease the wheels of society, I'm more comfortable with happy holidays as something which is not indicating an endorsement. Everybody knows that if you endorsed it, you wouldn't be saying happy holidays. Everybody knows that this is a compromise language that exists. So, you know, from that perspective, I think I'm more comfortable with it. No. Have a nice day, which may mean get lost. Hey, season's greetings is all on the same line as happy holiday, no? Where somebody hasn't initiated to you, if somebody hasn't said anything to you yet, so just wish them a nice day and move on. You know, have a great weekend, whatever. In the event that somebody said something to you, it's a good idea to have a stock response ready so that you're not caught on the spot. But if you're stuck with it, then I don't think happy holiday is the end of the world. I don't think it's that's so terrible because I think it is clear to people that you're saying that rather than endorse their particular holiday. Well, I think that's the heter for doing this at all, is you want to avoid Ava. You want to avoid it.
They know that you're giving them a shtach.
Right? It's not a shtach. It's an I'm different. We live in a pluralistic Canadian multicultural society. I don't think that they view it. I could be wrong.
Did you say thank you if they say Mary?
Yeah, can you say thank you?
What do you say? Like, when they say it, you can't not respond.
Right. No, but I think there, either, you know, if you have the opportunity to say have a great day, that's good. If you can't, if it's going to be way too weird, then I think you default to happy holiday. You know, I think that's the default that one goes.
Too.
Well, that's the same.
Like, if they say it to you, like, if they absolutely don't know anything about, they don't know your Jewish at all, and they go married,
wouldn't you two be like a man?
Yeah, that's interesting. Is you two better or worse than happy holiday? I think maybe it's worse than happy holiday. I think happy holiday is better. Well, you know, it's an interesting thing. I've actually found quite a few Christians who didn't know that Jews don't believe in that. I have encountered, yes, I'm... In Toronto, where Jews have, you know, sort of a certain size, you know, of community and a certain strength, not necessarily, but I have lived in places where absolutely they did not know. Like, they'll call up the synagogue gift shop looking for something for their holiday and be shocked to find out, no, we don't carry that, but if you want a matzah cover, that we can help you with. It's true. I mean, that's not. There are actually quite a few Christians out there who think that Jews celebrate it.
But isn't it also tricky this year because the 25th?
Yeah. Well, you can wish them a happy Hanukkah. If they want to wish me a merry, I can wish them a happy Hanukkah. Okay. So yes.
There are people that actually get offended when you say that.
Yeah.
And I know some.
They get offended.
They think you should just say, you know, like, Mary,
The question is that, well, is that going to lead to a breakdown in relations?
It is a problem when it's somebody that you work with.
Right.
Is that Ava, or is it just that they're offended that you didn't do what you wanted to do?
But if they're wishing you,
that may be okay.
Mary, whatever, then they know just as well, too, and they're doing it.
No, he's not wishing you that. He just went, if I say to him, happy holiday, he doesn't like that.
Wow. I would go with Happy New Year. David?
Is it really different than saying Christian versus Christmas?
Well, the difference is that when it comes to the word Christian, you're saying somebody who worships that,
right,
which is something the Gemara is fine with. The Gemara talks about people who are worshippers of Baal, Marcolis, and, you know, and all these others, and has no hesitation to do so. As opposed to, you know, talking about his birthday. I think there is a difference substantively between the two words. I wouldn't lump them together.
But if you said, just if you're having a conversation, like you're planning something out, you say December 25th, that's Christmas. Okay, that's different than saying Mary.
Yeah, I think it is different.
Yeah, one is about.
I would view that as different.
Building it up and saying it's something to be.
And if you have a reason to mention it, if you have a reason to mention it, like this is the day that they're off because of. That may be a difference.
There's a lot of non-Christians that celebrate it too, just because they live in Canada. So they're not celebrating it from a religious standpoint. They're just giving gifts to their kids, so their kids feel that they're part of society.
Yeah, understood.
And it's not a religious day for most people.
Understood. I happen to think that realistically, living in Canada, I think that most of our neighbors have an understanding that, you know, you don't have to be the same as them. But I think for the ones who are intolerant and you're going to have to work with, I think finding a good stock response and then using it, or a good stock even initiated, you know, something to initiate with along the lines of Happy New Year may be wise. Or, you know, good morning, good evening, something along those lines. Eddie.
That's an interesting point. You're basically just give recognition for somebody. Not just call them, over there, you're looting, I suppose. When you start to see them and refer to them as an old, what is it, what is it? And actually, call them a Christian.
Yes.
Because to go ahead and do, what's that snicker? You know, give that recognition.
Yeah.
I think it's a very fine line, I'm not sure if I understand the difference between recognizing that and recognizing worth it. Because what's the difference? You're recognizing that this has.
I'm recognizing that it's significant to him.
It's neither. You have this religion.
Yeah.
You have birthdays. You have your other mission. You know, to go and say to tell somebody Happy Easter, would that also be the same kind of an Indian? Are you also over something?
I think it has the same. I think it does have the same status.
To say that same status over,
yeah,
as opposed to them saying.
So I think that realistically what you are doing is giving it a certain degree of status, giving it a certain degree of strength, and saying that I recognize this as a special day. I think that is an issue. You know, I don't remember them saying ever. I don't remember hearing non-Jews say Happy Easter. Is that something they say?
Yeah.
They do?
Yeah.
Do they?
The Italians.
That's very funny.
Which is actually very funny because the Italians or the Latins call it Pasqua, right?
Right.
So right. It's even a Kaiser
connection. But no, it's true. I mean, I had an Eastern Orthodox priest who was a chaplain in a hospital where I used to visit people, and he always wanted to know whether there was one Adar or two, because the Eastern Orthodox Church sets the date for Easter based on when Pesach is. So he wanted to know, does he have an extra month this year or not? So, you know, hook him up with Ezra's Torah, and they'll give him a luach, and they'll base it on the nation of the year, and then hello.
I know.
Yeah.
It's amazing how other holidays, even it's the Yom Kippur, it's like
Where it's from is a good question. Yes. So the third and last of our subjects, since the first two were not controversial, are the topics of holiday presents and tips for the mailman and all of that. So there is a general issue, before you get again to the holiday context, there's a general issue of Lo Sechanim. The Lo Sechanim, a pasuk in Parshas Veschanan, has three different halachic interpretations, but one of them is Lo Siten L'matnas Chinam, of not giving gifts for free. In general, a Jew is not supposed to take resources that could be used for mitzvah purposes, and instead give them away as gifts to people who believe in Avodah Zarah. However, that's not really relevant in this context, because the gift giving that we're talking about is done as part of a culture in which one lives and participates, and there are penalties for non-participation along the lines of Eva. If you don't do this, you will have a problem. If you do this, then you know your paper will still be delivered to you and the like. So, right. This is not a spontaneous free gift consideration. But we still have competing sources on the issue of causing this person to be more enthusiastic in his religion. It's the Gemara at the beginning of Avodah Zarah that speaks about engaging in various transactions with people who worship Avodah Zarah around the time of their holidays, and a concern that then they're going to go thank their gods for their success in this holiday season. At the same time, the Gemara also in Avodah Zarah, it's further along in the Masechta, has a story of giving on their holiday, knowing that this particular gift would not increase their thanks. It wasn't going to have an effect. I didn't go through all the sources. I wanted to fit everything on one page. But if you take a look at the Shulchan Aruch that I brought you in number 16, I think it summarizes what you see out of both passages of the Gemara. Asur lishlamach doron la'ovei kochavim biyom chagam. You're not allowed to send a gift to an idolater. And here what we mean is an idolater. Going back to the question from before, this means somebody who actually celebrates the holiday and is religious in his observance. That's what we're talking about. If it's a general non-Jew, this is completely irrelevant.
Do you have to look into it? Like, who knows what your paper boy is, what he is? He's a 14-year-old kid who's just happy for the money. It's actually making him stronger.
Right. I think there are certain social assumptions that one can make. The you know, in terms of one's likelihood to be observant of his Avodah Zarah or not. But let's first see what it says in terms of its advice, because frankly, I think there are easy ways to deal with the problem, even if you are dealing with somebody who is religious. He says, you're not allowed to send a gift to this religious idolater on the day of the holiday, unless you know he doesn't care about the Avodah Zarah. He may be socially Christian or whatever, but he's not observant. He's not from. Ein yom hachag asur ela la'ovdim bo bilvad. Aval la'ovdim kochavim shesmeichem bo va'ochlim v'shosim u'mesharim osa b'nei minag v'nei kavod ha'melech. Aval hem einam modim bo harei elu mutarim la'seis v'la'seis imam. He says the concern on the day of the holiday is really only if they are from in their Avodah Zarah, if they just like to have a nice big family get together and they have a nice big meal, even if they go to church, it's not the point. The point is they're doing it as part of a general, you know, it's this is what we do type of a thing. And therefore, the fact that you gave him a bonus, the fact that you gave him a gift and it arrived that morning, isn't going to increase his enthusiasm in his Avodah Zarah. The Rama writes, "V'chaim shalech doron lo v'kochavim bizman hazeh biyom echad sheyesh lem siman o im yagil lem doron b'chag hahu im efsher lo yishlach lo mi ba'erev." He says, "And what if they actually have there are some Avodah Zarah that he knew about in Krakow in the 16th century? He's writing it based on a tshuva that was earlier. But if they have some kind of a celebration where, if they get a gift that day, then they immediately triggers a greater celebration." So he says to send it the day before in the evening, right? For them, they start the day that morning. So yeah, we start at night, but they don't. They don't consider it to be Leil of the Yom Tov. For them, they start that morning. Send it the night before. Vimlo yishlach lo b'chag atzmo. And if not, send it on the holiday itself. There's much less of a concern there. So on the basis of what the Shulchan Aruch and the Rama write, the simple approach is that if you know you have someone to give a gift to, give it early. they'd rather have it early anyway, right? Mm-hmm. They'd rather have it in advance. They're not waiting until that morning to receive your gift, you know? And this way, if they don't like it or whatever, they can re-gift it. They have options. If you gave it to them that morning, they're stuck. They have to hold on to it for another year before they can give it to somebody else. So, you know, you're being good to them. You're being good to yourself by making sure to give it in advance. I will note, though, for what it's worth, I write a weekly halacha in the Bayit Bulletin up north, and last year, the year before, I wanted to put this in a weekly halacha in the bulletin. Inevitably, what I do is I always send them to Rabbi Karapkin in advance because, you know, I don't want to put something out there for his shul that he disagrees with. I think maybe twice in the course of 6 years of writing these bulletins has there ever been an issue, but this was one of them. He felt that you can do it on the day of, and it's not a problem. He felt that in general there isn't such frumkeit in the world today, and people don't increase their even if they are people who go to church and everything else, they don't really thank and celebrate on that basis. My feeling is, if you can do it in advance, why not do it in advance? Just take care of it beforehand, and that way you've satisfied the Shulchan Aruch, which is very important, and you satisfy the concerns for Eva and getting along well with your neighbor, and at the same time, you haven't ventured into any halachically problematic territory. So, you know, to me, that's the simple way for a Jew to take care of it. Questions? Comments? What about accepting gifts? I'm good with that. Are you offering? Right. So you have the story, right? You have the story of Rabbi Yehuda Nissiya in that Gemara that the Ritva commented on, where he was afraid that accepting the gift was going to carry some special status for them and cause them to thank their God. I don't think we really have that today. I don't think unless you're the president of something. Your acceptance of the gift is generally viewed, as...
So, and then I'll be more specific with a friend that they couldn't make it here tonight, where they happened to have a family member that actually was a very brilliant family member that the good Pope, John Paul, if you can call that, was in dialogue with them, this woman, and they went with women went to the Vatican to meet the Pope. The Pope gave them a gift, which was a medallion of the mother and child motif.
I'm pretty sure the Pope knows what we believe and don't believe.
So it was pretty shocking. And could you? The strange thing was is that actually I looked at it. Turned it over, actually was...
Made in China.
It was actually... It was the people of Brazil, and the Pope re-gifted.
That's terrible. Like, before they came in, he turned to somebody and said, quick, what do we have? Okay. So Eddie's question, to boil it down to a more common case, perhaps. What if somebody gives you a gift that represents what they believe and what we are not supposed to believe? If someone tries to give a Jew a Christian gift, so I think that...
Easy answer to that.
Yeah?
You have a special opportunity for mitzvahs that you never get to do. You accept a gift.
The question is, if you are taking it, while I appreciate the idea of Biur Avodah Zarah, I think that the question is, by accepting it, are you causing them to believe that you actually accept this, that you believe this, that you embrace this? I think it's a very interesting question. I think if it were not a the Pope handing it and potentially a diplomatic incident, I think that the answer would be to politely decline. I don't want you to have to waste that on me. I don't have an appreciation for it because it's really not my thing. You might want to hold on to that for somebody else. Right. If you have anything else around that happens to be, 2,000 years old, I would be glad to look at that.
The normal case is you
one of these items is that it's a problem. So it's not, you're not accepting it in public in front of people. Like, it's already in your house. You have it, and now you have two choices. You could smash it, or you could say, I have a problem accepting it. You have to go and make a stink and actually go and give it back and say, I can't accept it.
Oh, boy. That's a really interesting question. Right, no, that's a very interesting question.
You're not going to re-gift that.
Right, no, you're not supposed to re-gift that.
Right?
The,
so
are
you going to go and give it back and say, I can't accept this, it's a problem, I'm sorry, thank you anyways?
That's a really interesting question.
Or do you just smash it because it's already done, it's already in your possession, and whatever, he already saw you accepted it anyways in a closed box.
Yeah. My gut is to say that you do not have a chiyuv to go back to him and say, I'm not accepting this. You can just destroy it and, you know, be on your way with it. My rationale for saying that is that I think likely they know this isn't your thing. I think likely they're aware of that. And it was given in a closed box, so you didn't have a chance to say anything then. But they're not going to take your continued silence. They're not saying they're tracking, like, you know, I gave Torchiner that object, and it's been like 5 days, 6 days. He hasn't said anything. It must be that he actually accepted my Christian gift. I think odds are there he's not. I'm just going to say, just for, you know, if anybody has to go at some point or anybody wants to take more food, you can. Like, the I don't want to, you know, overdo the time and create difficulties for people. Yes?
I had an interesting case. I had my accountant, just finished my accounting a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
And a few days later,